Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, and I am joined today by Graham Davis, digital editor. How are you doing, Graham?
Very well, thanks, John.
Stepping in for Bradley.
Indeed.
Where is Bradley?
He's gone out to lunch.
God,
believe it or not.
Disgraceful.
Now, the results season is finished. Everyone's gone out to lunch.
Yeah, Ian's out to lunch as well, isn't he?
Yeah.
Honestly. What do I pay these people for? And Megan Boxall. How are you doing, Megan?
Very well, thank you.
Good. And you're not out to lunch?
I'm not out to lunch, no.
What are you doing?
No, it sounds like a good option, actually.
Absolutely. You've written the cover feature this week.
I have,
and
yes.
One of the big news stories.
Mm-hmm.
Some drugs.
Yep, lots of drugs.
Lots of drugs
in the news.
Yeah. Big magazine this week, isn't it?
It's chunky.
Kind of happened a bit by accident. I mean, we have a lot of results still, so probably 15 pages of results, something like that.
Yeah, there were a lot last week.
Yeah, we would usually have expected it to have quieted down a bit by now.
But, a lot of little ones crept up on us, which we weren't expecting.
Yeah, I think this catches out every
year.
You did this for years back, Graham.
I've done this, yeah. Every year, September surprises people because it just keeps going.
I'm so tired.
But I think it genuinely has quietened down to quieten down next week, I think.
Okay.
Only four pages next week, I think.
Only four?
Yeah.
Lunches.
Wow. Yeah, good. So look, we've got lots of results, pages that haven't got this week to fill up next week with someone else. So wonderful. Let's start with big news of the week, Graham. 7 days.
Well, first of all, Twitter. How about that, John? I know you're a big fan of Twitter.
Love Twitter.
Do you think it's worth $16 billion?
I've no idea.
Apparently some people do.
How much money does it actually make?
Very little, if at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is kind of important.
It is important in the social media landscape. And what is interesting is the names being linked with it, because the talk has kicked off again this week that it's, you know, going to be bought, possibly.
Okay, but there's no actual deal on the table.
No deal on the table, but...
But there's speculation.
Speculation. We've got Google lined up as a possible buyer.
Okay.
Disney's another one that's been pushed this week, which is interesting.
Sounds implausible.
Yes. Microsoft.
Actually, Microsoft, you know, I'll tell you what, they got the worst Twitter client of all phones on the Microsoft mobile operating system. It is absolutely shockingly appalling. So
that doesn't bode well, then, does it?
No, not really.
Bring the two together. There are links there. The Twitter chief exec is on the Disney board, Jack Dorsey. So, you know, that people have put two and two together and got $16 billion out of that one. It's you know, there could well be something going on there.
There's some investment bankers having a little bit of a fish.
Yeah, indeed. I just linked to that, the sort of, and linked to this podcast as well. I see that Spotify is apparently buying SoundCloud, which some of our listeners may be listening to this on speak.
I like SoundCloud. Mm. Good platform. Mm. German company, isn't it?
It is, Berlin based. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, which is, I really like SoundCloud. I think it's an interesting model. There are other podcast hosting sites out there, but they've kind of done a good job of wrapping that up, I think.
Yeah.
So that kind of makes sense to me. Because it would sort of make it a natural competitor to iTunes.
Mm, indeed.
Although, of course, we're distributed through iTunes as well, despite the fact that we host it all on SoundCloud. I mean, it's a little bit of an incestuous market there, but that makes more sense to me.
Mm, indeed. That would make Spotify quite a powerful player. And obviously, you know, that is its big rival is Apple. Apple Music is growing fast. So.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, what do they call them? Unicorns.
Mm.
Unicorns.
Tech unicorns.
Everyone wants a unicorn.
Yes.
There you go. Okay. What else we got?
This week we've also seen news from the supermarket sector with news that Aldi is ploughing another £300 million over 3 years into expanding its estate in the UK.
Yeah, well, you know all about that because there's a big one opening near you, isn't it?
Indeed. In Colchester last week, the biggest Aldi in the UK opened.
Have you been there?
I haven't been
there. Were you queuing up at midnight?
No, but some people were queuing up at midnight. Apparently more than 100 people were waiting at midnight the night before because there was a free TV on offer.
I remember when they opened a big IKEA on the North Circular a few years back.
Riots.
Do you remember that?
Yes, at Edmonton.
And they were giving away some really cheap... They weren't giving them away. They were just cheap.
Meatballs?
No, sofas.
Oh, sofas.
Meatball sofas, they were right. The police got involved. I mean, it's worse than Black Monday in the US, isn't it?
Well, they're a bit more refined in Colchester. There was no rioting.
No rioting, good.
Glad but it is telling that.
Well, that's unusual for Colchester.
No, they're very well behaved out there.
Really?
Normally. Yes.
I've been watching a program on Sky called The Force. Episode one was in Colchester.
The Squaddies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's rough.
Yeah, they don't shop at Aldi then.
Where do they shop?
I don't know.
Lidl. And I've got a Lidl me. And I guess the point of this story is that these discount retailers are continuing to expand in the UK. Their market share, I think, is now about 10%.
Yep.
Which is roughly equivalent to Morrison's. Yep. You know, so their aggregate market share is as big as our fourth biggest supermarket chain. Not to be taken lightly. And in fact, the interesting link here is that we got our friends over at SharePad to have a look at the supermarket sector this week in this part of this series of running, really hoping to encourage investors how to learn, how to really analyse what's important about these sectors. And supermarkets is one we looked at this week.
And the house builders one that Phil Oakley did last week was really popular online and in the magazine. It was a real hit with the readers. So this supermarkets one should be equally popular, I would have thought.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and in fact, what we're doing is every time we run one, we'll get the IC writers to kind of have a look at that analysis and then follow up with our house view the week after. And in fact, although Phil's analysis sort of suggested that house builders are a bit of a fragile point in the cycle.
Mm.
Jonas's view is that actually the cycle could be extended for quite some time because of the kind of big trends that have supported the growth until now. Shortage of housing, government support.
Yep.
It's a question of, you know, when will that cycle end? Not if, because it will fall over at some point, but it looks like it could go for some time.
Yeah, I saw an announcement today that Philip Hammond, our new Chancellor, is pulling the Help to Buy scheme. I'm not sure which one, because there's several different versions. There's a London one, there's several different versions, but there was a news piece in one of the papers just that I read this morning saying that he was going to announce the pulling Help to Buy. I don't know.
The autumn statement, that would be.
Probably.
Yeah, that would be catastrophic for that sector.
So, one to watch, I think.
But yeah,
as I say, there are several different versions of the Help to Buy scheme, so I can't tell you which one it is at this point.
Yeah, neither can I.
Mm. Talking of government, government-supported banks have been in the news as well, with RBS in 7 days here as well, with the chief executive, Ross McEwan, admitting that with the sale of the Williams and Glynn unit probably not happening this year, the bank is now in uncharted territory. Because if you remember, the sale of this Williams & Glynn unit was part of the European Commission's stipulations around state aid when the bank was bailed out.
Well, indeed, I thought it was an obligation, not something they wanted to do.
Yeah. Indeed, and you know,
they have tried.
They've tried. They've spent £1.5 billion trying to separate it from RBS to float it.
Have spent £1.5 billion just trying to spin this out.
To try and spin it out. Then they decided they couldn't because actually separating their IT systems was just too complex.
What have they spent £1.5 billion on?
I don't know. That's a very good question. and then the idea was that they would sell it. And now Santander, who was the latest candidate to buy it, has pulled out.
What is it? I mean, it's branches and some customers, presumably.
It's a few hundred branches and a few thousand customers and a legacy IT system, which obviously is fiendishly difficult to pull out of the rest of the business.
It doesn't currently exist as a separate bank. It's not a high street bank.
It's not a high street brand, no.
So it's kind of creating a new bank of some brand that RBS owned before.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So which customers would be part of that? I mean, you know, it's a good question. It is bizarre. I'm not surprised it's difficult. My dad actually used to work for Williams & Glynn's before it was taken over by RBS.
Not in IT, I hope.
I don't think IT existed in those days. No, it's in personnel.
Okay.
Before it became known as human resources. Mm. Personnel. That's something you don't hear very much anymore.
No.
It's bizarre. Maybe they're hoping that they can hang on for long enough that by the time the separation might happen, we won't actually part of the EU and therefore not have to follow the state aid rules.
Maybe. And you know, I think there are discussions that have to be had between the Treasury and the Commission to see what happens here. There is some rumours that a buyer might still emerge. you know, last minute job. CYBG are being mooted as a buyer, but I thought they had their own issues in terms of trying to cut costs out of their own business. And
CYBG, remind me who that is.
Clydesdale and Yorkshire Bank.
Oh, that's the one, yeah.
We floated not that long ago.
Yes. Probably could do with scaling up a bit, so.
Yeah, so.
Mm.
Watch this space.
But I mean, it's not been an entirely happy week for RBS generally. No. Problems in the US.
Or, I mean, banks in general. I mean, the one thing RBS did do this week, which actually clears up a bit of the concern around it, is it reached $1.1 billion settlement with a credit union in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Over the
mis-sale of mortgage-backed securities.
Mis-sale of mortgage-backed securities, which is the big issue. And that is something that has dominated the banking sector in Europe this week, because Deutsche Bank, which is teetering, to be honest, has been hit with an $11 billion fine by the Department of Justice in the US. Again, with regard to mortgage-backed securities. So the fear is that a similar fine is coming down the line for RBS.
Yeah, terrifying.
RBS can probably afford it more than Deutsche Bank can. And that's why Deutsche Bank has been in the news this week, because Deutsche Bank is its credit profile is not brilliant.
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion that Deutsche is going to have to take some government bailouts here.
Yes, although Ms. Merkel has said that there will be no bailout. There will be some sort of bailout, obviously.
Well,
Deutsche Bank comes to the crunch, there will be some sort of bailout. But
are they going to let it go bust?
No, of course they're not. Of course they're not. But, you know, for keeping up appearances, she wouldn't allow the Italians to bail out the Italian banks recently. So she's set a precedent there.
So yeah.
We'll see.
Oh dear. But you make your bed.
Well, exactly. But there are all sorts of cocoa bonds and
cocoa, but they sound so nice, don't they?
They sound so lovely.
Until they come and bite you in the arse.
That, you know, they could be converted into equity. There's ways that the bank could be propped up by its debt holders. Or it could just go to the market, but the share price of Deutsche has been hit so hard that they probably don't want to go to the market at the moment.
No, and I mean, in the case of RBS, I mean, you know, a $9 billion settlement sounds pretty awful as well. They might be able to afford it. But then we've also got, which I don't think we mentioned in this article, but the prospect of there's still the civil case hanging over it for the, essentially the misrepresentation at the time of the rights issue pre-post the acquisition of ABN. Can't remember if it was before or after, but
I think it was after. But
yeah, I thought
but
it was
not
after.
Long after. But I mean, it is.
But related, nevertheless.
It's all related. It's amazing. They were almost, we're almost 10 years on from these events.
Is it really that
2007, 2008, you know, we're almost into 2017. We are approaching the 10-year anniversary.
Where has 10 years of my life gone?
Well, it's terrifying, isn't it? But the legacy is still there. It's incredible, really.
Well, I think it will be there for a long, long time. Yeah. You know, this is not going away.
No.
But then, of course, America's dishing out some big fines for some, you know, dodgy practices of European banks at the time of the credit crunch. But, you know, let's not forget Wells Fargo recently has been in the news for some really quite appalling practices.
Yep. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I don't think anyone was squeaky clean in the banking sector over the past a decade ago.
No, we haven't. But I mean, you mentioned the Italian banking crisis, but as far as I'm aware, that hasn't actually been resolved yet.
No.
We just stopped writing about it.
Yeah. Everyone seems to have stopped writing about it for now.
I don't.
It's not going away.
No, so yes, I mean, the banking sector is still very, very worrying indeed.
And Ian Smith actually wrote this piece, who was covering banks until recently when he became company's editor. And he's, you know, he's looked at some ratios and numbers on the Deutsche Bank and RBS in particular. And it looks, you know, they're being priced at, you know, incredibly low levels compared to the book value.
But then I'm looking at that return on equity figure there. I mean, minus 11%.
Yes.
So for every pound they spend, they lose 11% of it. Mm. I mean, you know, 11p. I mean, that's just, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And how are these businesses, how are they, you know, this is no way to run a business.
No.
And we thought the supermarkets were bad, looking at Phil Oakey's analysis this week.
Exactly. I mean, it was the Credit Suisse chief exec, TM. This week, Tijan TM, who was in a rather unguarded comment, described the banking sector as uninvestable at the moment.
He's probably right.
And I think he withdrew that comment very quickly. But
he did say it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the world doesn't work like that anymore,
I mean,
does it?
According to Ian's figures here, the European banking sector, as on average, the return on equity is less than 3%.
Yeah. Low rate environment.
It's low interest rate, indeed.
You kind of can see how that might be the case, but yeah, generally not good.
No.
Not good at all. Should we talk to Megan?
I think Megan...
You're sitting there squirming at us discussing the hideousness of the banks. I mean, let's talk pharma because, you know, that's been...
Megan's very investable.
Investable. Absolutely. But let's talk small pharma first. Yeah. Redx.
Yeah, so Redx has got an antibiotic, a whole host of antibiotics in the pipeline, ready for development. And they couldn't have chosen a better week to announce that they've got all these antibiotics because at the end of last week, the UN met and decided that antibiotics resistance and bacteria that are able to fight antibiotics are the greatest and most urgent global risk.
Well, this was something we did write about... I don't think you wrote it. I think Alex wrote this one, actually, on when we did Finding the Cure series. Yeah. I think Alex Newman did the antibiotic series. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, did the antibiotic episode. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's something you follow closely, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. And then we wrote about it in the summer when Jim O'Neill came out with his report. He has obviously since left, but his report...
Jim O'Neill? Goldman Sachs Jim O'Neill, we're talking. Bricks Jim O'Neill.
Yeah.
What's he got to do? Antibiotics?
Yeah, so he wrote a big paper on the problems of antibiotics and the fact that it could stretch into economical problems as well.
Yeah, all right, yeah.
Lord Jim O'Neill, he was part of the government until this week when he resigned.
Yeah, I'm just surprised. Sorry, I hadn't realised he'd written about antibiotics because I didn't realise that was his area of expertise, but there you go.
He's been a big voice in the in pushing this meeting, this summit, this getting people to talk about the crisis. Anyway, so they've had the meeting now and the UN has decided that they're going to be really prioritising getting around the issues of antibiotic resistance. And yeah, Redx Pharma's in a great position now. It's got antibiotics, it's got new antibiotics. It's an interesting business. It's had an absolutely shocking time since it listed in 2015. But its share price is back on the rise again now as people start taking a bit more interest.
So what's it got? I mean, it presumably has some stuff in development, nothing that's actually being sold
Yeah, it's far away from sales.
Phase one, phase two, where is it?
Most promising product is actually a cancer product. It's in phase one, moving into phase two. Antibiotics are preclinical. They've just finished preclinical studies, and that was the big announcement. So getting past... There are two major hurdles. The first one in drug development, the first one being getting into the clinic, starting to test your drugs in human, and then getting the drug onto the shelves, having tested it in human. So they have now got the drug in the clinic. And they'll start phase one and then maybe look to partner with a big pharmaceutical company. But that's what makes it really exciting, I think, because if the UN is saying we need big pharmaceutical companies to be investing in antibiotics, they're going to be looking for acquisitions because they're not going to want to develop them, which makes Redx a prime target for acquisition. And people are going to be fighting for it if it's got what it has got. And there are very few small companies who have got antibiotic which is this far along the development pathway, so that's great news for them.
Yeah, and we had a bit of feedback from a reader recently on the history of antibiotic launch and discovery.
Who knew it was so varied?
So it's often said that there hasn't been a new antibiotic launch for 3 decades.
Yep.
That's not entirely true, as we discovered.
No, we did.
There has been a launch, but in terms of new classes, mm-hmm. there hasn't really been a discovery for a very, very long
time. Yeah, so there have been new classes, they've been new launches, but they've been for very specific illnesses. There haven't been, like, penicillins or drugs which treat bacterial infections, which... cause a wide range of illnesses. So that's what Redx Pharma thinks it's got, a completely new class of broad spectrum antibiotics.
Let's hope so. So I mean, that's one to watch, and we'll talk about your drug discovery feature in a minute, the pipeline feature, and you know, let's hopefully we'll see this in there at some point. But I think it's, you know, we'll put this in context of the actual route through which big new drugs get to market in a minute when we come back to that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about National Grid for a minute because I think this is a fascinating story.
Indeed. Yeah, there was some concerns raised. There was obviously a news piece this week that National Grid may be selling some of its distribution business.
This is gas distribution business.
And part of it, it was a news story because the buyers are likely to be from overseas and probably
China.
From Asia, maybe China or Singapore, you know, the usual suspects, people who are after long life income producing assets. The other concern raised here, and some of the Emma's alighted on in the news spotlight, is that although it may provide a short term cash boost for National Grid, and some people are saying it could be an £11 billion deal, the question it raises in some investors' eyes is that does it affect National Grid's ability to pay its own dividends over the long term?
I hope not, because I've got some of those shares. Out of all of the utility related companies, this one has been less volatile, let's say, than some of the others.
Probably the most boring. But
it's really boring. That's why I like it. I don't think its management is stupid. And I can't believe that they would want to offload such an important part of business that would undermine their ability to pay the dividend.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the question being raised about this potential deal, is why are they even selling it? Why do they need the cash now?
This is why I was asking Mark, Robbo, earlier this week, when we were talking about energy storage, for example. Why are they doing this? You know, have they got their eye on something else?
Yeah.
And I can only assume that they have.
Mm. Maybe they're looking to do a deal. I mean, they do have a US presence, a big US presence, National Grid, so maybe they need the money to invest over there. It's all very much up in the air. But Ofgem waded in a little bit this week because they made a statement about it, which suggests that these talks are genuinely, a long way down the line if Ofgem are making public comment upon these assets.
Well, I don't believe that these are just, this is pure speculation, because we know that the Chinese buyers have been interested in similar assets in other parts of the world, notably Australia.
Yeah.
Well, there has been uproar, of course, that they want to sell a crucial part of their infrastructure to the Chinese. But it is interesting. And, there is definitely something here. My question is, but why would they do this? I really think they'll carry on paying a dividend. I just wonder what they've got up their sleeve.
Yeah, that is the fascinating thing. And I noticed that Emma kept National Grid on a buy here. And, it is interesting to see what comes out of this. It looks like a deal's going to happen probably around the turn of the year.
Power. Hey? Well, can't do without it.
Nope.
You and I, Graham, are likely to have to live in the shadow of a nuclear power station as well.
Indeed. Chinese are bringing nuclear to Essex.
They are indeed.
Wonderful.
I think you're about as close as me.
Yeah. You can see it on a clear day.
Can you?
Yep.
Oh, I can't see it unless I actually get around the bay a bit. But, Bradwell, we're talking about, listeners. Yep. Fascinating stuff. So, there's much more news in the section this week, but we need to leave something for the readership. Let's jump back to Big Pharma.
Yeah.
Because this is a subject that I find fascinating. I mean, Big Pharma shares were obviously, they did very well after the referendum.
Very well. Yeah.
Presumably because people were interested in the security of their dividends as much as anything else. But there have been big questions about Glaxo in particular and its ability to pay a dividend, given that its pipeline of new drugs seems to not be appearing as fast as its old drugs move to generic status. And I guess this is the big question of the whole industry, and you've kind of answered the question about where the next big drugs are coming from.
Yeah, so that was exactly the idea of the feature, just trying to identify where the big sellers will come from. Investing in a pharmaceutical company, you're looking at what's coming up rather than what's gone, because by the time you get a drug onto the market, the patent doesn't actually have that long left.
No, but you are interested in the cash flows that the existing drugs are bringing, and that's where the dividends come from.
And that's what, so they at the moment they have to have new drugs to prop up those cash flows. GSK is the prime example of a company that's cash flows have really struggled as drugs have dropped off patent, and they haven't had new ones coming through to back that all up.
GSK is a funny one.
I mean,
you weren't in last week's podcast, but we did briefly discuss the change of management there, which looks really, it's an unusual move. So the new chief executive, Emma Walmsley, she is a marketer.
Yeah.
By trade. Mm-hmm. And she's been in pharma for a while, but previously was at L'Oreal. So, yeah. I mean, it's quite an unusual choice of chief exec for a big pharma group to make.
I think people were surprised. There hasn't really been very much talk, which was also a bit surprising because there was so much talk when Andrew Witty decided he was going to retire. And people were very vocal who was going to replace him. And now it's been announced and there hasn't been an awful lot of chat apart from sort of tabloids who've been
tabloids.
The fact that she's a woman.
Oh yeah, yeah, right, that's about the long and the short of it.
Yeah, that's pretty much all we've got so far on comment on the new GSK chief executive. But yeah, she's a marketing person.
Yeah, well, yeah, but that's what it says to me. I don't care if she's a woman or a man or alien. Yeah. I don't care. What does it mean for the strategy of this business?
Well,
and it suggests to me that they have an idea of where it's going, and it's a kind of consumer-y.
Yeah, route. It kind of looks like a statement. That they're not going to spin off their consumer division, which mm-hmm. a lot of people have been calling for them to do. They've been spending a lot more on the consumer section than they have on drugs, which is why their pipeline is really not that impressive. So I think by appointing a chief executive who has such a marketing commercial background, they're saying, no, we're keeping our business together. But it is evolving into more of a consumer healthcare business. It's more of a Unilever than it is an AstraZeneca anymore, because it's just got so much more reliance on those consumer sales than it has on current drugs and future drugs.
Indeed. That said, in your first section of this excellent feature, which is about respiratory drugs, mm-hmm. this is a big area.
Yeah,
but Glaxo's your favourite here.
I know. So it was... I'm not Glaxo's biggest fan. The magazine isn't Glaxo's biggest fan, but I do think it's exceptional at respiratory drugs, and I think it's a massive market, respiratory, because there are various reasons, but mainly the population is huge. There are so many asthma sufferers, there's so many people who suffer lung problems, pollution, smoking, they all play a role, and GSK has just dominated the market for such a long time. Its product Ventolin, which was discovered in the 60s, is still making billions. And that just shows how much of a grip they have on the market. And they've got new ones coming through which are beating AstraZeneca, and they're beating some of the big US companies into launch. So they've got what they're calling their triple inhaler. The triple inhaler is a new type of inhaler. The full science is very complex, but they...
Which we won't go into here. We're a financial magazine, we don't need to. But there's a lot of science in this feature.
Yeah, there is. Because it's difficult, I think, to explain it without... It's difficult to talk about the market without talking about the science.
I think you've done a really cracking job of boiling that science down into something that we can actually get our heads around as investors.
Yeah, it took me a while though. Whew, there's a lot of questions that you've got to be asking people. And so many times I sit on the phone to some of the chief executives of the smaller companies who are often scientists.
Mm.
And they're like, why don't you understand this? But it's so complicated. Anyway, Big Pharma is more about the fact that they are launching these drugs rather than the early stage science. And GSK is doing very well in the respiratory section. And one of the reasons it can do very well is it's got lots and lots of money to plug into marketing. And in respiratory, more so than in other areas of medicine, marketing plays a massive role. It's all about the brands. People are used to their little blue inhalers, which have Ventolin on the side. That's a GSK product. They are comfortable with that product. And it's going to be the same with these new products coming through. They're going to be reassured by the fact that it's the new updated version of their old inhaler.
Who makes the purchasing decision? The doctors? The physicians?
Yeah, and also the patients.
The patients do make it.
Well, they can. If they're not comfortable with a decision, they can say...
I just look at these names. I mean, these don't chip off the tongue a lot, these drug names.
I know. And,
I'm not having that. I'm going to have this.
But actually, that's another thing about Glaxo. More so than Astra, their names are easier to pronounce. So, for example...
Here we go. This is the good stuff. This is what investing's all about. How
what
easy to pronounce
say?
Names are.
I was actually on a media call with the CEO of Hikma, which is the fourth largest pharmaceutical company in the UK, and its CEO tried to read out one of its drugs names, and he said, oh no, who's made up this name? I can't pronounce it. which I thought was a real refreshing thing to say.
I've got to say, as an aside, the same thing is true of the ETF market. I mean, the names in the ETF space are just absurd. And I've said this before in this podcast, sort it out, ETF industry. anyway, let's, I digress.
Yeah, so GSK's got a lot of respiratory products. They're going to be launched before AstraZeneca's. They're going to be launched before companies in the US. And we can say their names. So for respiratory, yeah, GSK is, well, I think, winner. Outsider, Vectura is a much smaller company, and it's competing against big pharmaceutical companies. It's got a £1 billion market cap now, but that's nothing compared to really big players in pharma, and it just hasn't got the firepower behind it, and I can't see it competing. I think for a small company to compete in respiratory, it's got to target really specific patient populations, which Verona Pharma is doing, Merio Biopharma is doing. They're doing interesting things in very specific disease populations, severe COPD, for example.
And that's a smoking-related illness.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it is fascinating. But the thing, I mean, you know, the thing we've kind of been hearing about the pharmaceutical industry for a long, long time is that there's nothing close to launch. And I think this is why you think now is the time to be starting to look at the pipelines of big drug companies, is that actually there's a lot that's really close to the end.
Yeah, definitely. So there was a gap. There was a big gap where pharmaceutical companies were spending more on that marketing than they were on research and development.
The patent cliff, I think they were calling it, weren't they?
Yeah. So that's been around for a while, but it's coming to an end now, and there are so many, like you say, just on the edge.
In fact, there's one that you mentioned just before we started recording.
Yeah.
Kite Pharma.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so, you know, that's taken us all by surprise.
Yeah. So I actually mentioned it. It was kind of an offhand way because the CAR T therapy race, it's a very novel type of cancer therapy involved in extracting cancer patient cells, correcting them in a lab, reinserting them back into the body. But that race to develop that therapy first had been won or was being in the process of being won by a company called Juno Therapeutics. Second was Novartis, had a lot of exciting progress coming on. But Kite Pharma has surprised us all, and it today announced that it had gone through its clinical trials, finished phase 3, and was ready for approval with the FDA.
I can't get my head around how we're surprised by this, because this clinical trial process takes a long, long time. So, I mean, you know, you're talking years. A phase 3 trial can take a really, really long time. And, you know, you've got the companies keep the markets updated as to where they are.
Yeah.
So I don't understand how they've kind of suddenly said, oh, no, it's done.
The thing with this one is, and it's the same with all rare diseases, is they can be fast-tracked through. We had it earlier in the week with a drug for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. The FDA completely surprised everyone by saying, yeah, go, you're ready, you're done. And for rare diseases, for really, really poorly people, the drugs can be fast-tracked through. So I imagine that's what's happened with Kite Pharma. I don't actually even know if they made it to phase 3 trials. I think it could have been a phase 2 trial, because the FDA can say if the results are good enough from a phase 2 trial.
This is the Food and Drug Administration, which is essentially the body that approves
new drugs. In
the US.
Yeah. Which is the soul of the pharmaceutical industry. So everyone wants to be approved by the FDA. But yeah, so Kite Pharma has surprised everyone. But yeah, I think that really shows just how much stuff there is coming through and how open it is. It's in oncology, it's not necessarily the big pharmaceutical companies that are going to win the race for launching drugs. It could very easily be the smaller players, because it's all about getting the right trial results. It's not about getting marketing. The first drug on the market is going to be a big success, because these drugs are so important to so many people, and they are saving lives. Where respiratory drugs and cardiovascular drugs are prolonging lives, cancer drugs are literally saving people, a lot of whom are quite young. So that's why I think the oncology market's so exciting, because everyone is on a level pegging.
I think it's a cracking feature. I really do. And you're going to do some more of them, aren't you?
Yeah. We're going to keep monitoring the drugs pipeline. We've got a few. We did have some more to watch, little box, looking at some of our favourites from the UK.
So their shares have gone through the roof this year.
Oh, they've been amazing. More good news for GW this week.
Oh, yes. In the tip updates page, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been a very, very good, well-performing tip this year.
What have they done this week?
So they've got this drug, which is in phase 3 clinical trials. It's had four phase 3 clinical trials. The first one, which it announced in March, sent the share price up 125%. This is the third positive update, and So yeah, another approval. So they're going to be ready to launch next year. And it's a very interesting one, very controversial one, because it includes cannabis, treating children. But if it's working, great stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's plant-based medicine.
Exactly.
Cannabis is just a plant. So there you go. As I said, Megan, great feature. Thank you very much. Drug Discovery, I mean, it's been, you know, for many years, it's almost felt uninvestable because it's so difficult, but things feel like they're moving in the right direction.
It's just so exciting. That's what I find. That's why I love it.
Yeah. And I think you do a good job of helping us to understand it. Actually, I was looking at the tip updates by Sainsbury's. They had some results this week, didn't they? Graham, or an update.
They did.
Talking and, going back, you know, to groceries, going grocery back to very quickly. Sector,
yeah, it's tough. It's tough out there for the big guys. Sainsbury's has basically, its sales were pretty much flat if you include fuel. Take fuel out of the equation and they were down 1.1% like for like. Volumes actually up. They're selling, you know, selling more stuff but for less and at lower margin. So because of the price war. And that's the Aldi and Lidl effect. Basically.
Not going to get any easier, is it really?
No, it isn't. Interestingly for them though, Argos, in its first quarter under Sainsbury's control, performed pretty well. Their sales were up like for like 2.3%. And they're opening up loads of these digital click and collect booths within Sainsbury's shops.
Oh, I can't wait.
Very exciting.
I don't actually go in the shops anymore. Actually, I did go in my local Tesco. We haven't got a Sainsbury's.
I haven't been near a Sainsbury's in months.
No. Oh, well. Yeah. Let's have a quick chat about results. I mean, there's quite a few this week. Megan? Pick out something that you covered this week that struck
Cicasia.
You. Cicasia. Because they've had a bit of a torrid time
interesting
recently.
Interesting one, yeah. So Cicasia failed the drugs test. Prime example of why investing in small cap farmers is risky. But GW is how it can be great. Cicasia was the opposite to GW. It was in phase 3 trials. The trial failed. The share price fell really hard. And it's been left with a whole different pipeline. It's now had to focus on its backup plan, which was respiratory. So it's been a difficult few months. I don't think the summer's been very kind to Cicasia, but they have got a backup plan. It's just not going to be the same as it was. They were going to be in the high growth niche area of allergy therapeutics, and now they're just another respiratory player.
And there's a lot of those, as we heard.
Just said, there are so many of them.
And there's some guys out there that have just got much more muscle.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's a shame, but their results were fine, as to be expected, and the sales for their respiratory products are moving in the right direction, so that's something.
Okay, let's talk Bar, Graham. They had results this week. I mean, they're also in the news section. Yes. Because obviously they're in the eye of the sugar tax store.
Sugar tax, indeed. AG Bar, Iron Brew is their main.
Quite sugary, isn't it?
Quite sugary indeed. you come by Diet Iron Brew.
Can you?
Yeah.
I can't imagine they sell much north of the border.
No, exactly. But they had results this week, and as well as the sugar issue. And Bradley wrote in the news section about the sugar tax and how the drinks companies are kicking off, saying it's not just us.
Oh, I agree with them. I completely agree with them. I don't understand how the cake industry is not being targeted, or the sweets
or
industry.
Chris,
I do think they've got a point there.
I mean, we had a well known cake manufacturer who I will not mention who had results recently, and they sent us a bag full of cakes.
I broke out in spots.
I'm not going to complain about that.
No, well, I will, because honestly, I broke out in spots that next afternoon.
It kept the office going for a week.
How many did you have?
5 spots.
But to single out
and lots of cake,
it's the cake. It is. To single out the drinks industry on sugar it does seem a little bit too focused.
Yeah, I agree. But then what I think what they're possibly arguing is that a lot of these things have been marketed traditionally at younger shoppers, and it can cause disease. Mm-hmm. I guess diabetes being the main one is something we may be looking at in future drug features. So yeah, but they also did something which makes me really angry.
The classic.
Weather.
Blame the weather.
It was too cold.
Too cold for Iron Brew.
This summer, I've literally spent the summer sweltering on a train and in the office. It doesn't have felt too cold to me.
This was the period up to the 30th of July, so
it's still quite hot.
It was. I mean, obviously, we've had a long tail to the summer, so they did say they've done well since the end of the period. But yeah, June and July must have been okay, and surely even in Scotland it must have been okay.
I just just weather.
No,
makes me mad.
It's a terrible excuse that companies use too often.
Somebody else blamed the weather. I can't remember who it was now. I've been reading it.
It was Bon Marché.
Oh, no, it was somebody else apart from them. But what did they blame the weather as well, did they?
Because Bon Marché, you know, they had all their autumnal coats and things in, and no one's buying them because it's still warm.
Someone has blamed the weather today. Vernalis, which is a drugs company, blamed the weather. Too warm for cough and cold medicine. In America.
I had a cold last week.
There you go.
Oh, in America. Because no one gets cold, summer colds in America.
No, but it was too warm this year for cough and cold.
I don't know. I will make a plea now to the companies of the listed companies of Britain. Do not blame the weather, even if the weather has or may have affected you somewhat. It really is a feeble excuse.
Well, exactly. And for drinks companies, there will always be periods in the year where it's colder than normal, and there will be periods in the year where it's warmer than normal. It evens itself out.
I haven't heard Fevertree blaming the weather.
No.
For anything.
Exactly.
So, anyway.
They're riding the gin boom, aren't they?
I'm riding it too. All right. Okay. We're running out of time. So, anyway, thank you for that. As I say, it's an absolutely action-packed... It's an action-packed cover.
Yeah, I know.
Quite a cover. Do you like it?
Yeah,
do you like
I do.
It? It's, if you go to Canary Wharf, there's a big news agent up there called News on the Wharf, which is big fans of ours, which is good to hear. They actually have these big screens outside their shop, and we give them an animated cover, which they put up.
Nice.
So this is animated in Canary Wharf.
Go and have a look. That's a tourist attraction in itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes, anyway, so what else have we got? We've got James Norrington, who's done us an asset allocation update for the autumn. What James does, goes away, looks at some of the tactical exposure research that some of the big investment houses, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs and such like are doing, and repositions his kind of ETF-based portfolios to take that into account. We've got 50 objects, as I promised. We had a week's break. We're now up to number 36. We're going to get to 40, have a break, and carry that on in the new year. Chubby Checker, the twist. Who'd have thought that had anything to do with finance? But it does. We have, as I said, Phil Oakley's SharePad piece this week on supermarkets. We've got lots in the personal finance and funds section. They've had a good week, haven't they?
Award winners. Yeah.
The Association of Investment Companies, which is essentially the trade body for the investment trust industry, has recognised their writings about investment trusts again. They're regular winners of this award.
They got an individual award and a team award.
Leonora got the individual award, and they got the team award.
Yep.
And well-deserved as well.
Well, I think
our investment trust coverage is up there with the best of them. And actually, talking of investment trusts, Algernon, Algy Hall, has... So usually his stock screens look at companies, but Algy is a great fan of investment. That's where he began his career, isn't he, right? About investment trusts.
Investment trust newsletter.
Up at CityWire. Were you?
Mm-hmm.
He's done a screen for investment trusts, which... over time it's been okay. Not a great year this year in terms of performance, but the strategy back tested is an absolute corker. Sector focus on data, which is an interesting industry. So it's a part of the media which is possibly overlooked. You know, you think media, you think TV news, but what you don't think about is data. We spend fortunes on data in the office. Fortunes.
It makes the world go round, data now. It's incredible. Incredible. It's a commodity, but
it's a valuable commodity.
It's a very valuable commodity, yeah.
Absolutely. Of course, all the usual tips, lots and lots of results that we haven't had time to mention, much more in the news section. It's been an exhausting week, but I hopefully think it's been worth it. The next blockbuster drugs on sale in all good news agents. Now, thank you, Megan. Thank you, Graham. Pick up the magazine, £4.70, which is a bargain for the amount of content you're getting this week, or go online, subscribe. Thank you very much. See you next week.